Welcome to Court and Controversy. I'm Janine Yunus. On this program, I'll be discussing a wide variety of controversial topics with some of the most original thinkers of our time, and no holds barred. I bring a litigator's perspective, and my guests will come from different backgrounds and industries. Enjoy the show. My guest today is Michael Schellenberger, who probably needs no introduction for most people. But for those who don't know him, he's an author, journalist, founder of Public. He is a CBR chair of politics, censorship, and free speech at the University of Austin, and the founder and president of Civilization Works. He is also well known for his work on the Twitter files. Thank you so much for joining me today, Michael.
Thanks for inviting me, Janine. It's great to be here.
Well, can we start by talking a little bit about your background for people who aren't familiar with your work and your, especially insofar as it relates to free speech?
Sure. So let's see. I'm a Gen Xer, born in 71. My first journalism was when I was 15 years old, which means that I've been doing it for 38 years, which is crazy.
That's a long time.
What did you start with as a teenager?
Yeah. Your school paper?
What did we do? You know, of course for people that know my work or know, you know what I'm doing, it's like I was mixing reporting and opinion from the beginning, and no one was ever able to break me of it. So this whole thing where people are like, oh, there's this mixing of news and editorial, like there's always that conversation in journalism. And for me, it's like, that's what it's always been. And then I definitely like to pick up causes over those 3.5 decades of advocacy, you know, like human rights, Central America stuff in the 80s. I went to Nicaragua when I was 17. I've worked on radical left causes really all the way through my 30s, and then worked a lot on the environment, which culminated in my 2020 book, Apocalypse Never, Why Environmental Alarmism Hurts Us All. And then after that, I did a book on homelessness called San Francisco. And, you know, basically helped to create a global pro-nuclear movement, a civilian, you know, not funded or connected to the industry at all movement, helped save a bunch of nuclear plants. I've also then helped create two coalitions on homelessness in California and across North America. And never thought I'd work on free speech issues because I thought it was like a settled issue. Yeah.
In the 1700s.
Yeah. Well, or at least in 1977, really, with the Scogie ruling, of course, yeah. which reinforced Brandenburg and defended the right of neo-Nazis to engage in political life in the United States.
Right. And for people who don't know, that was a case where the ACLU chose to defend neo-Nazis in Skokie, where a lot of Holocaust survivors lived, and the neo-Nazis had wanted to march through and, you know, celebrate their white supremacist beliefs. The ACLU has changed a little bit in the intervening years.
Yeah.
And so would you, I think most people consider you to have sort of been a leftist who, either turned to the right or sort of became moderate or centrist. What's your take on your own political journey?
Yeah, I mean, there's accuracy to that. I mean, I would say, and then of course, I think we would all agree the left has changed significantly from the 90s, you know, or the 80s. I mean, in the 80s, the left was pro-free speech, pro-respect for gay and lesbian relationships, anti-military intervention in Central America, which was the number one cause for me.
Just out of curiosity, what was your interest? Where did your interest in South America stem from?
Well, probably at a personal level, for some desire for adventure and action coming out of living in a very suburban, you know, very typical suburban 80s, you know, nice, good childhood, you know, but boring. And in a pretty conservative town, in Colorado called Greeley, but yeah, it was just more like, it was a big issue on the left, and I was just a young leftist. You know, I was probably on the left front, at least since I was 15. I mean, that was an important year because I was doing journalism, but I started an Amnesty International chapter. Sting was promoting Amnesty International. It was a big deal. Anti-torture was a big part of it, because of course, you know, our guys kept getting caught torturing people in, you know, Nicaragua and El Salvador and places that had certainly had torture before then. And sort of was just a kind of basic, your basic lefty, progressive, human rights, Central America type, and in the 80s. I think on the free speech thing, the most interesting part of it, and maybe the one that I think a lot of other people experienced, is that for me, support for free speech had become so intuitive, and that was what, you know, academics would say, naturalized. I didn't think it was something that I had been indoctrinated in, but then I look back and I realize that I had been, and then I had been around Skokie, and I had experienced a period of shock when I remember distinctly my father telling me about Skokie and being like, what? That doesn't seem compassionate. And, you know, I think the reaction that a lot of people on the left today have to hate speech online, I think I had. And it really took some time. It took, you know, what cognitive scientists, including, you know, Daniel Kahneman, would call, you know, type two thinking, kind of slow thinking, hard thinking. Okay, I see. So if we don't let the Nazis march in speech, then you won't let the communists march in speech.
Right.
And then you're going to be like, well, those people are Nazi adjacent and those people are communist adjacent. And the next thing you know, you're going to have completely, you know, there's a slippery slope, and you learn about a slippery slope,
right,
you know, when you're young. And
there was
and so
actually,
a lot of,
do you know CJ Hopkins? He tagged me in something
of
on
course.
Twitter. He, you know, he had published some books where he was comparing like mask wearing to Nazi symbolism or something. And he got prosecuted for that in Germany under their hate speech. So I think that's sort of a great illustration of why we don't have hate speech laws, or we shouldn't have hate speech laws.
It is a totally good example. Yeah, but it's hard. Like, you know, it's not intuitive. I think in some ways, I think free speech is not intuitive. And I thought it was.
Yeah.
And I realize now it's not, and that you actually have to teach it. You have to teach it to kids. We have to teach it to everybody. But certainly, I think, you know, you have to educate people about why we have that tradition in the United States, and why it's the First Amendment and not the 29th or something, and why really... I don't want to oversimplify a complicated history that I'm not expert in anyway, but my understanding is that a fair number of America's creators, you know, not just like the founding fathers, but the, you know, the colonies that approved to create this country, literally didn't want to have a country unless they had free speech. Like, it was an existential issue. It wasn't like when we pound our chests and say, I would die for free speech, that's a very American specific tradition. And it's very righteous and spiritual, in my view, and beautiful, and something that I think is so beautiful that I'm actually have been happy to make it kind of my number one issue over the last year and a half, even though, you know, I don't know that I'm still learning it. You know, I feel a little embarrassed by that chair position that you mentioned at the top, because there's certainly people that have written books on it. I've never done that, you know, and I'm grateful for the position and intend to try to fill out those shoes. But there is a way in which I just knew, when I realized what the threat was and how it was working and operating, it also helped to help me understand why, you know, ACLU and Amnesty and everybody's been so bad on this, on the new censorship. It's complex. It's very, very sophisticated, and it's hard to understand. It's not obvious. And so having to make the case for free speech in this environment is also very intellectually exciting for me.
When you say in this environment, do you mean on social media as opposed to sort of more traditional forms of media or speech?
100%, right? Yes. I mean, we always talk about, you know, you and your listeners know about the Bantam Books case. And obviously that was a big part of the case of the Murthy decision. But yeah, I mean, you go back and obviously like all these First Amendment cases were decided, you know, pre-internet. And so you get to the internet and it's a more complex, in some ways more scary and dangerous. Like, the levels of control you can have are much closer to total control than when, you know, they were hiding printing presses in the Netherlands and, you know, sneaking pamphlets out. Like, there's a way in which it's like, it seems decentralized, but it's not. It's actually become really centralized. And that means that it can be more easily controlled by authoritarian powers, you know, particularly states, but even, you know, big tech, and the ways in which big tech can become an arm of the state. And to some extent, it always has been an arm of the state. And it's just a matter of degree. That became very interesting to me. So it's been a delight to work on the issue. I mean, I was telling people, and, you know, people thank me, you know, in Brazil in particular lately. And well, it's like, you know, it's a pleasure to work on this issue. It's in part because I think people know it's the right thing, even if they in the details and the day-to-day take the wrong position. I think at some level people know that it's the righteous moral cause that it is. But we've allowed ourselves to be kind of manipulated by some very sophisticated actors that want to have control over the social media platforms.
Right. Well, yeah, we'll talk a lot about that soon. So you said you got involved in this issue about a year and a half ago. Was that with the Twitter files?
Yes.
And so can you talk a little bit about how you came to be one of the Twitter files journalists and how that led to your work with Free Speech Now?
Yeah, I mean, the short version is just that, we all saw Matt Taibbi get invited into Twitter by
Was he
Elon
the
Musk.
first one?
Yes.
I couldn't quite remember.
You
How
know,
do
and
you
then.
think Musk chose? I'm actually very curious about this. He chose kind of the people who reject a lot of the wokeism and who are questioning COVID policies. Was that your take on it?
Well, I know the whole thing, but when I was with Matt in Congress, he declined to talk about, he didn't want to talk about it for some reason. I'm not even sure I know why, because there's certainly nothing wrong with it. But he has chosen in front of Congress, and then of course it was the subject of, as you may know, some threats after we testified. I probably shouldn't say, but there's nothing super interesting about it anyway. It's not important. But yeah, so Taibbi found himself at Twitter. Getting documents from Elon Musk and his team, and then we all were watching it, of course. Everybody was. It's a major event, and so then, and then Barry Weiss texts, and she's like, it's just very Barry. It's like, I'm flying in from LA, and I was like, I knew exactly when she said, I'm flying up to San Francisco from LA, going into Twitter. And I was, of course, I'm like, well, yeah, she, of course, Barry just crowbars her way into that situation like immediately. She's such a good reporter and such a good journalist and such a star. So, and she was like, can you come over and help? And I was like, as soon as I finish this Zoom call, I'm out the door, no shower, no combing the hair. I'm like on the bridge over to San Francisco.
I got a call. I forgot when this was in relation to when you and it was certainly after Taibbi, but I got a call from Jay at like 11 at night because I'm on the East Coast, and Jay Bhattacharya, and he was like, "I'm on my way to the Twitter Files headquarters. Elon Musk just asked me, can you give me some search terms?" I was like, "Oh, I was about to go to bed, but I guess so."
Amazing.
So what did you find there?
Well, just to continue with Jay, basically Barry and Matt were in the room with, and Matt had one person or two people, I can't remember. He had two people with him, and Barry had like a team, must have been like six people, and it was just me, and they had already kind of decided what they were going to go hunt for. And so speaking of Jay Bhattacharya, one of the first things was to figure out who had been shadow banned, and meaning had their accounts throttled in some way that they didn't know about. And sure enough, they looked at it, and there was Jay. And literally, it was like the little button on his interior profile for the Twitter staff to see, but not for others to see. But we were able to see it now. It said Trends Blacklist. And I remember just thinking, boy, I was like, this story is going to be like, that's fucking crazy. Like, because of course you always go, we go, there's blacklists, and people are like, oh, that's hyperbole. And you're like, you're exaggerating. I was like, wow, the button says blacklist on it. I was like, this is going to be really big. So, so she did that, and I had
And
nothing to do
that
with
meant
that.
that, what do you think that meant that his account like came up
Yeah,
less than the
there's nothing on
algorithm?
trends. It could never come on trends. It could never be promoted. So, I
I
mean, I think
see.
everybody knows, but I mean, just the basic understanding of social media, so people know. I mean, there's sort of the people you follow, but everybody knows the real action is in the recommendation engine. So, what's being recommended to you in terms of content? Like, that's where all the action, like, everyone goes, TikTok's algorithm or whatever. It's just a really good recommendation engine. Like, it's telling you seem to be this kind of person. You've hovered over this. You stayed 5 seconds on that video rather than 1 second on this one. So, they get really good at recommending. So that's like where all the action is. So if like Jay Bhattacharya, is not allowed to go viral, basically. He's on the trend. So he can't trend. There's a category, I think it's still there, trending. So he can't be trending. And when I talked about the sophistication before, I mean, one part of the sophistication here is, and this is very, very important, and people don't understand, they have to, is that what the censors want is to decide who can and can't go viral and who can and can't be recommended. They realize pretty early on that they don't need complete censorship. And in fact, in many ways, it's actually backfires. you know, it causes the Streisand effect. What you really want to do is just make it so people, you know, what you really want is what they call shadow banning. That's right. That's the term shadow banning, which, you know, there was this whole thing where Twitter's like, well, we don't shadow ban anybody because they didn't use that term, right. You know, but they've I don't want to exaggerate, but they have dozens of mechanisms to do shadow banning that are much more sophisticated than shadow banning. And to sort of suggest that they don't do it was deeply dishonest.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember, so I tweeted a couple times in 2021 about how I wasn't going to get the vaccine because I had natural immunity or whatever. And they would censor those. So those posts were actually censored. And then I would take screenshots and like retweet or send them to other people. And then it would actually get more attention. So as you know,
how do you know they were censored? Did they actually take them down?
Like people couldn't like or retweet them, and it would say something like this.
They
post
put a label
is misleading. Now it was 3 years ago. I can't remember exactly.
But they labeled it. Yeah,
they labeled it, I think you're right that that's less effective. I think I'm also, or I was for a long time, shadow banned too because I tweeted a lot about the vaccines, and right. I would get less engagement.
Yes,
but
they would have and they would probably have an algorithm on the content, right? In other words, so it wasn't like. They didn't have to have hundreds of people looking at the hundreds of or thousands of power users on Twitter, you know, that are spreading, you know, disfavored views on COVID. They just needed to have the algorithm set up in particular ways, and it would do it on its own.
Right, right. But as you point out, I mean, in a way, when I actually got, you know, the sort of unable to like or retweet and sensitive, you know, whatever, this is misleading post, lots of people would pay attention to it. So it has, as you said, like the Streisand
effect.
Whereas I think you're totally right that the shadow banning is much more effective and just limiting.
Yes.
And I mean,
absolutely.
One thing about Jay, again, I assume most people listening to this know who Jay is, but for the few who don't, I mean, he's a top epidemiologist worldwide, and he's a professor of medicine at Stanford. And he wrote the Great Barrington Declaration, where he eschewed the notion of lockdowns, saying that they would probably do more harm, that they would do more harm than good, that they weren't historically supportable in terms of the practices we've done in order to, you know, try to limit deaths from viruses. And he nevertheless was, turns out, put on a Twitter blacklist. So his message and the message of many other scientists who said the same thing was suppressed. And it turns out that the government was behind a lot of that, but we'll get to that in a second. And I think, you know, that sort of shows the danger of censorship. We adopted a lot of policies like lockdowns and mandates that turned out to be really bad for public health. And that was done because dissenting voices were silenced, even very highly qualified ones. And again, that's why we don't put the government in charge of censoring. And, you know, I think there are big questions. And you're sort of more of an expert on the tech companies because, you know, I really focus on the government in my work. That's just part of what we do. But we'll talk about that in a sec, I guess. Why don't we talk about it now?
Yeah. I was about to respond to say, I don't agree. I think you're an expert on the big tech companies too. And I think that you can't properly think about government and tech in this situation as separate. I mean, there's just too many, they kind of create each other in a way, you know, particularly just this fundamental distinction between a social media platform and a publisher, which is in the 1996 law that allowed for this, you know, broad liability protection for the social media companies and allowed them to become, you know, powerful monopolies, Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. I mean, it's a huge, huge issue what to do about all this. And I'm not sure how you want to get into it, but I mean, I will say, yeah, go ahead. I was just saying, because there's the cases too. Well, because you get right into the cases and I think it's sort of, you can get into the weeds a little bit. But I mean, basically, you know, we've had this law that gives this really broad protection to social media platforms against liability protections, whether people violate copyright or defamation or whatever. Now the social media platforms still have to take content down in those legal cases, but it allowed them this extraordinary power. And yeah, I mean, what we discovered with the Twitter files, and the reason I work on free speech right now, and will probably for the rest of my life, honestly, at least in some way or another, is because these tech platforms have become so big and powerful that they really do have a huge amount of control over everything. You know, I mean, like, you know, psychological health, you know, the development of children, the creation of psychogenic illnesses and social contagions.
I mean, the formation of public policy.
The formation of public policy, who's a legitimate, you know, political candidate, who's not, is basically an issue of governance. I mean, we've always known that the media was powerful. You know, Alex and I just did a piece on this yesterday. You know, Hearst runs for office, and like these media, you know, like Rupert Murdoch chooses Margaret Thatcher to become prime minister. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but I mean, you kind of go, the media in some ways is the governing mechanism of the society. It's how the society makes politics. It's much more in that direction than the ways in which politics creates the media.
Right.
And then I would go a level further, and you go, it's really the technology that creates the media that then creates the politics. So you have an extremely interesting phenomenon where, you know, the printing press and then, you know, telegraph and radio and newspapers and then TV and radio and then the internet just have these massive social and political consequences that last for decades.
Right. And I mean, in a way, social media has kind of democratized these things in that, you know, it's not the mainstream media that, you know, and when you said Rupert Murdoch, Margaret Thatcher, like, because anybody can participate, it makes it much more democratic. But then on the other hand, when you have the government coming in or these companies
right.
with so much power, that creates a whole new host of problems. So, and I think sort of the project of this age for those who care about free speech is to figure out how to deal with those things and those sort of
things.
So let me talk briefly about the Supreme Court cases that were decided. They're immensely, I think, important to the future of the current understanding of free speech in our society. So the first is Murthy versus Missouri, which was decided about 10 days ago by the Supreme Court with a 6-3. So the majority of six. We had an adverse ruling, essentially, and I represent Jay Bhattacharya, Martin Kulldorff, Aaron Cariotti, and Jill Hines as individual plaintiffs in the case. And they allege that they were censored on social media because of the government's involvement. So that's why it's a First Amendment case, because the government can't use private companies to do what it can't do directly. And here, that's censor based on viewpoint. Unfortunately, the court kicked the case out basically based on standing. And to be clear, this was only a preliminary injunction. So the underlying case is still going forward in the lower courts. Most people don't know that, which is understandable. But this was sort of an emergency motion that went up on appeal. And Justice Barrett, who wrote the majority opinion, repeatedly said they didn't meet the standard for a preliminary injunction, which is a higher burden. However, there was a lot of, you know, problematic stuff in the opinion, I would say. And in a general sense, what they basically said is, well, none of these plaintiffs can show that they were censored because of the government. The social media platforms had censorship policies in place beforehand, you know, misinformation policies, however you want to put it. We can never know that any of these people were actually censored because of the government. That's highly problematic because it means that the government can basically demand that companies censor entire narratives, entire lines of thought, which they did. They demanded that the companies censor people discussing vaccine injuries, people, the lab leak theory, for example, and numerous other topics related to COVID and other subjects. And that's a First Amendment violation. I think most people would agree with that, but nobody can bring the case because nobody can show that their specific post was censored because of the government. There may be a few people like Alex Berenson and RFK Jr. who were singled out by government officials who may be able to meet that heightened standard, but it's not consistent with the case law. It's not consistent with the First Amendment. It's a very problematic decision. And then the other case is Net Choice. And that was Texas and Florida had passed laws saying that the companies, the major tech companies, can't censor people based on expression of disfavored viewpoints. And the states challenged those laws, saying that it violated the laws violated their First Amendment rights to editorial discretion. Like, newspapers have, you know, the government can't force a newspaper to print certain things. And I think most people would agree that that's correct. But here, the states argued that these are only sort of the platforms are only hosting speech. They're not actually conveying their own message. And so they don't have First Amendment rights, and they can be regulated as common carriers, like a telephone line or a train or a telegram service. Essentially, those those companies are not permitted to discriminate against people based on viewpoint or for any other reason. So reading the two decisions together, I would say my conclusion is the court has basically said, I didn't say what the court's decision was. It was a sort of fractured decision, but the majority agreed that the platforms have First Amendment rights. And that was dicta, so it wasn't central to the holding, which basically means it's not binding going forward. The only holding was that the cases had to be sent back for more fact-finding because the record wasn't developed enough. But nevertheless, the majority agreed that the platforms have First Amendment rights themselves, which I think is a very controversial decision. And I sort of reading the two together, I sort of see it as the courts are willing to protect the rights of corporations, the First Amendment rights of corporations, which are controversial. And I'm not even, I have mixed feelings about those. And then unwilling to protect the rights of individuals, which I just don't think that the framers of the Constitution understood that to be what the First Amendment meant. But anyway, I would love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much to say about that case. You know, I heard it in person. I flew out in person and spent that, chunk of money to be able to get somebody to stand in line so I could stand in line. And then
I learned about that. I didn't actually know you could pay people.
It's really the only way to do it. Yeah, they have to spend the night to get these limited seats. And I'll tell you one funny story. I was sitting there waiting in line, and I see there's a person. I'm in line. I just paid my ticket holder to take whatever we Venmo'd the money or something, and then I'm waiting in line, and I look up and I see this person looking for her place in the line, and I realized it was Renee DiResta, who is kind of my main antagonist in the censorship industrial complex. She just got fired from Stanford Internet Observatory, which is the main of the censorship groups that we've been criticizing. And sure enough, she was two people behind me in line. And, she comes back and she finds her spot there in line. I just, kind of go, "Hi, Renee." She goes, "Hi, Mike." It was like, all right, we're all here in this little crazy democracy. At least it's, it's sort of something. I think because we both, I would think fair to say, don't have very positive opinions about the other person right now. But it was also like, it's nice that we can stand in this line and have this court figure this out rather than hopefully not being in court and killing each other or at war or whatever.
It's fine. My own little story about that. So then we'll get back to the important stuff.
Oh, no, tell me.
So before Missouri, I actually filed a lawsuit. It was very similar in philosophy, but it was just against HHS and the Surgeon General on behalf of three Twitter users who'd been censored for COVID misinformation. They were actually friends of mine. And we had noticed that they were getting censored every time the Biden administration made public threats. So I thought there was enough to bring this suit. And I was up against this guy. I won't say his name. But he lived near me, and I ran into him at the grocery store multiple times. But he had this, like, he acted like I was the stupidest person on the planet for bringing this up. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, they obviously don't have standing. And I ended up losing based on standing and then got involved with the jury. And so I'd keep to him at various court proceedings. And, one of us would always be on top, kind of like smirking, and the other. And then when I saw him at the Supreme Court arguments, I was like, aha, here we are in the Supreme Court. But then I walked out with less of a smirk.
It's funny. I feel pretty good about our system right now. I've been in a darker place over the last year and a half, but despite this ruling, I'm actually in a pretty positive mood. I mean, I definitely think we're still in a bad situation when it comes to censorship in the United States and globally, but there's other things that make me more happy about our system and the ways in which I think it does have, and I think the thing you just pointed, the thing I would start with in terms of Murthy is just the thing you ended with, which was just, I do think this is not over and that the standing issues seem to be, a big problem. And we didn't have, we discovered things in the Twitter files and after the Twitter files that couldn't go in the Murthy case, the Missouri and Louisiana lawsuit case. So in some ways it was born too early or something. It was early. And I think, we have so many examples of government coercion resulting directly in the social media companies changing their policy, particularly if I have to think of one top of my list would just be White House pressuring Facebook to censor on lab leak and censor on vaccines. And it's very clear that Facebook felt coerced because they were worried about losing White House support in dealing with Europeans who controlled a bunch of data that they needed.
And actually, that I don't know.
Business.
In his dissent, Alito actually cited that, which I know you wrote a long article about.
Oh, great! Yeah, I gotta look at that. No, it's great.
He actually addressed that and the lab leak theory. So, because that the lab leak theory emails came out in a congressional investigation, which I was actually working on. It was shortly before the argument in the Fifth Circuit, so we were trying to figure out if we could get it into the brief somehow. Nick Clegg, who's an executive at Meta, had emailed another Meta executive and said, can you remind me why we were suppressing the lab leak theory on Facebook? And the other guy goes, it's because we were under pressure from the White House. We shouldn't have done it. Which if you want to put a clear indication that the censor is happening at the government's behest, I think that's it. And that actually made it into Alito's dissent too, but it's not technically part of the record. So it couldn't actually be considered.
But also we also have a problem because Kavanaugh then, of course, this was part of the oral discussion in the hearing. It was Kavanaugh's like, I worked at the White House and we would call up reporters all the time and try to get them to kill stories. Yeah. And so that's where you get right to this thing of like, you kind of go, well, wait a second, dude, this is like not calling a journalist and arguing about their story. This is secretly demanding. This is demanding that a big tech company that you have huge control over secretly engage in mass censorship. That's completely different than calling up a journalist to argue about a story. And I think the fact that he didn't, that he reached for a comparison to the analog era kind of says everything about some of the problems with this issue and with the case.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure that it should be okay for government officials to call up journalists and say, don't you dare publish this story. I mean, maybe there are arguments in cases of national security and stuff. That's probably the exception I'd make. But just like, this makes me look bad. Don't you dare publish this. I actually, unaccompanied by direct threats and the power to carry them out, which I think was a crucial part of the case in Murthy. I mean, maybe it's not a First Amendment violation, but I don't like it. I don't think it's good behavior. I think the fact that it's an accepted practice, maybe it shouldn't be. That should be re-examined.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I mean, you're a PR person for some government official, and you're going to make your case to the journalist. And the way you make the case is by telling them that it's not a story. That's how it always works. You're like, it's not a story, and you shouldn't publish this. I mean, I think that's tricky to try to ban that. Now, I do think you should be, in this case, I mean, first of all, my point was simpler, which was just that I think you don't want to be in a situation where we have to go win that argument in order to establish that the government can't pressure big tech to do mass secret censorship. I mean, that should be that's a much more cut and dry situation in my view. And so, I would just say a note of hope is that I don't think it's over, and that if we see the kind of mass secret censorship that we saw, over the last, 3 to 6 years, 7 years, we are going to have a better case. But of course, the thing we haven't talked about yet is like, and part of my good mood is that we just, Twitter is not what it was. It was really a controlled organization, heavily controlled by the state, whether by the kind of deep state, foreign policy establishment operating through its think tanks and cutouts, or by the intelligence community. And under a significant amount of additional pressure by Congress and the White House, I mean, I think that's just gone now with Twitter. I mean, there's some effort by Twitter to appeal to advertisers, but it's just nothing what it was. And so part of it is, for us and thinking about free speech, defending free speech going forward, I kind of go like the main event is shifted from where it was just, 2 or 3 years ago.
Right. You mean the main event has shifted because of Twitter being taken over by Elon Musk, or?
Yeah. Yeah. And the visibility we have now and our own. So we've gotten much faster at identifying government disinformation / censorship campaigns. And that's how we think of it, is like these censorship demands are almost always preceded by disinformation by the government. Whether that's saying that the lab leak is impossible, or the vaccines prevent infection and transmission, or that the Hunter Biden laptop is a Russian hack and leak operation. every time, all the major, or you know, that we have to lock down, you know, we have to keep kids home from school in order to prevent, you know, transmission and infection, and that's good for the kids. That's all, like, I think it's important to point out that, like, and those are some of the big ones, you know, like those things, there's disinformation coming from the government first, and then they're demanding censorship on the basis of that disinformation. And certainly we also have cases where we're defending the right of people to be wrong, or a disagreement about things that some people would say is still wrong or whatever. But I think the interesting dynamic for us is where we start to notice the governments of the world engaging in disinformation campaigns. We now are able to figure out that they're doing that within a matter of days or weeks, as compared to a year and a half ago, where we're really, or 2 years ago or whatever, we're really people, I guess there was some awareness of it, particularly around the Russia collusion hoax. But I think there's now a much stronger understanding of people that the government is doing this, you know, yeah. And we're much more vigilant and aware of it, so that if they try to do it again, you know, if like Rene D'Arresta reconstitutes at Carnegie or Harvard or some shit like that, you know, like, we'll be on to them. We can see them.
Yeah.
They put out stuff, we can debunk it. And then I think even, you know, with X, you know, we see, you know, the concerns are they're trying to, you know, they're trying to get back with the advertisers, and they start working with all sorts of unsavory characters. Yeah. You can see the censorship. I mean, like, you know, Turkey and India and Brazil are these kind of big cases that were ongoing before Elon bought Twitter. But, you know, and Turkey demands that he censor things, and he demands censor things. He did kind of what I recommended, which is that he published the requests, and he found a way to do that. And Congress then subpoenaed some of that for Brazil to publish the censorship requests. And that has a huge impact. The same thing we were talking about before of the Streisand effect. So I would like to see... That's a long way of saying I would like to see in the future, or I'd be happy to see in the future some new cases brought to the Supreme Court, because I don't think that the issue is dead for us there, even if, you know, this with the defeat on Murthy. But I also think we're in a different place than we were between 2020 and 2023 or 2020 and 2022. And
yeah,
and that means that I think my own focus has changed a bit.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, I remember early on in the pandemic, I was at the time a public defender, so I wasn't doing anything close to this. And I asked a constitutional lawyer, like, why aren't people challenging these crazy lockdowns and mandates and stuff? I mean, they seem clearly unconstitutional, or at least there are certainly arguments about misuse of executive power and stuff. And they said, well, when there's an emergency, judges tend to be very conservative, you know, small c conservative.
Mm-hmm.
They don't want to do anything, but they don't want to be seen as, you know, assisting in killing people.
Right.
And so you just create bad law if you bring the cases. So even though when the emergency is happening and people's liberties are being violated, unfortunately, that's usually not the best time from a legal standpoint to bring the case. And I think that's actually kind of true. And mm-hmm. I've seen it in the vaccine mandate context, where this ridiculous case from 1905 called Jacobson versus Massachusetts, where the Supreme Court said that the smallpox vaccine could be mandated, has been used to justify all kinds of vaccine mandates that are completely different. And although I challenged it on multiple times and so did a lot of other people, only recently did the Ninth Circuit in California hold that actually Jacobson has been misapplied, which is the argument I've been making for 3 years or something.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, so I think, you know, I think we can probably bring this case or another one reconstituted, and perhaps, you know, once people like you have done more work revealing just how toxic this censorship is and how extreme it is and how it's really having an influence on public discourse and policy, that maybe the justices will start to understand more that this is not. It's almost like they're a little bit, I think they're a little bit behind us. You
yeah.
Know?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's probably to be expected. And yeah, it's still early days. And yeah, who knows? I mean, I think it's still not great in the sense that we just depend on Elon Musk more than any of us should feel comfortable depending on any single individual. And I think we've been very fortunate to have somebody in Elon who is very pro free speech, but it may not always be that way. And the structural dynamic of the social media platforms is such that, I mean, you know, there's not, I mean, like, it, I mean, the interesting thing is people talk about different social media platforms, but like, there's only really one that has a significant influence over kind of political life, and it's Twitter.
Right.
You know, it's just not Facebook anymore. It was for elections a little, you know, back in the past. I guess it's still that role for some election campaigns. But in terms of like conversations around like politics and policy, there's just one, and that's it's Twitter.
True. I mean, YouTube for videos, I think, though, and there's quite a lot of censorship. Yeah. YouTube. I'm still getting. I've had videos taken down as recently as last month. Not my own, but where I was talking about like this case for medical misinformation.
Yes.
Ridiculous.
And you see TikTok is censoring. I've been getting censored more on Facebook. It's now, unfortunately, I worry this rising effect wears off, and that, you know, it's like it becomes the censorship goes from being a man bites dog story to a dog bites man story, and people kind of go, yeah, it's terrible. You know, I mean, that's what's really scary. And that's what starts to, that's the totalitarianist threat that I think is really powerful, is when, you know, if X had stayed Twitter and remained in the hands of the censorship people, then the state really exercised control over the media. And that's dangerous. That's bad. You know, and it's sort of soft, it's softer censorship, it's less overt, but it is able to control what becomes matters of concern.
Yeah.
You know, and so you see matters of concern in the society now have shifted. It's all, unfortunately, it's so multifactorial. You can't attribute all of it to Elon, certainly. You know, like we have a huge border crisis and whatever, but like, I don't know, like, would the border crisis stuff and the migration stuff be going viral on X under the older regime? I don't know. They might have prevented that. You know, they were really censorious, and they are really obsessed with allowing a lot of migration. So, you know, and it's the same people, namely Soros and Midyar to some extent, Craig Newmark's foundation, you know, the same people demanding kind of very open border, you know, policies, very pro-immigration policies, are the same people that were doing any censorship. And I say that as somebody that's actually pretty pro-immigration. It isn't really, not even saying something about immigration. I'm just saying something about free speech, you know? And so I think the fact that Elon has able to make that change has changed the conversation significantly. But yeah, I mean, we just did a piece yesterday where we were just sort of marveling in ways in which, you know, the media really is, you know, drawing on this, you know, questionable German theorist. He's like, you know, just caveated this Nazi German political theorist who nonetheless made this very important point that that the most powerful body in society is the one that can basically declare a state of emergency, you know, and that's usually that had traditionally been the heads of state, the president, but really we argued in this piece that it's really the media now. You know, the media takes down the governments and decides who can be president. And it's kind of shocking when you think of it that way, because it's not the older picture of democracy that we have, where there's this kind of fair and balanced, you know, we get our information and we make up our own minds and we vote for our people. No, it's really a machine that is deciding what we should think about a whole set of things. And you know, people have always made the point of the power of the media, so that part's not new, but I think we're making it even stronger, kind of being like, really, like all the major decisions happen at the level of media, and then they kind of get implemented when you get into politics and the law. I mean, you know, and the government agencies, the cultural attitudes, that the media is just such a big part of that now that, you know, on the other hand, that awareness, you know, and then the change of power at X has broadened that debate and changed the media. So in some ways, that's why the source of my optimism. I'm like, you know, the broader conversational envelope that's allowed by having Elon Musk control X, it's just such a difference between now and 2020. It's like hard to even, I mean, I think it's huge, the difference between social media today than in 2020. But I think the threat of the kind of censorship that we saw is still there, particularly if Elon, for some reason, is no longer in control of X.
I don't like the idea that our free speech hinges on one man's continuing to control a corporation.
I know. Problems. Doesn't sound right.
What's your opinion about the types of legislation at issue in net choice, like state laws, or would you be in favor of federal legislation that sort of prevents the platforms from censoring, or what do you see as the one of those?
Yeah. Well, I spend a bunch of time trying to figure out my view of the policy over the last, you know, really particularly a year ago, I did a white paper on kind of just what I would want or what we would want before getting to my view on all these other things. Because you sort of, as soon as you start working on this issue, you sort of discover there's all these proposals of what to do. And so I came to a position that I was, I guess you could call it common carrier, although I didn't want the baggage of it in my, in our proposal, but I was proposing, and just to simplify it, that adult users should control all of their legal content and their legal and their, and the filters and algorithms to getting that content on social media platforms. And that would mean that the platforms would need to be pretty transparent about those algorithms, that you would be able to choose your filter. You could choose Jeanine Yunus or Michael Schellenberger or Elon Musk or Greta Thunberg or Al Gore or Joe Biden or whoever's filters, or you could create your own filters, but that you needed to have that control, and we needed to give the control. And that you don't have to do that, but then you don't get, you're not a social media platform. Then you can be a publication under Section 230. So,
and then you can be liable for what people say on
yes.
your platform. Yeah. So you don't get both.
No, I mean, you're not liable for it. I mean, I think if someone puts up illegal content, you still have to take it down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one thing that bothers me about the platform's arguments is they say on the one hand, like in the net choice cases, oh, we're publishers. We have First Amendment rights, basically. We should have editorial discretion. So we have First Amendment rights to convey a certain message. And that's that we don't tolerate hate speech, or we don't tolerate misinformation, whatever that means. But
right.
on the other hand, they have protections from Section 230 saying that they're not
right
for what people. So they kind of want to have their cake and eat it, too, in my
yes.
opinion.
Yeah, I agree with you 100% on that. In other words, we have an existing distinction in the law between public publishers and social media platforms, which the law, I believe, calls interactive computer services. We have a distinction in the law, and maybe we should get rid of it, and someone could make an argument for it, but I think the distinction is fine. Yeah. I think it's good because it allows the social media platforms to operate without being crushed by lawsuits. You know, assuming that they're operating, you still have to take the illegal content down, but you're not responsible for it being put up in the first place.
Right.
And then those have free speech rights and whatever, but that's the deal. If you want that amazing liability protection that comes with the privilege of being a social media platform under U.S. law, then you have to agree to allow adult users to moderate their own legal content. And obviously you can hear in the language, I'm carving out an exception on illegal content and on minors, which I think are separate issues. But on the adult, but that means that, you have to be able to see the, and then I don't know, are the social media platforms going to like it? I told Elon that's what I thought we should do. I think that the platforms, they like having control over their algorithms. They want them to be secret. I think to some extent I'd be open to them being able to keep parts of the algorithms that are, to the extent it's even possible, that are not, related to the social and political content. And I think that's fine, but I just think that people should control their own content if they're going to be on the platform.
Yeah.
It's not, I don't know. I've testified on it. I gave testimony. I submitted testimony. I talked to members of Congress about it. I don't think that they're, hasn't caught fire that way. I haven't sold it. I haven't really pushed it either because I've been busy with other stuff and I'm not in a situation to be able to do that. But that's kind of what I think you should have. And then when you asked me about various pieces of legislation, that would sort of measure them against, does it get us closer or further from that ideal?
Yeah. I mean, I was sort of torn about the net choice decisions. And I don't know if you heard decision. Well, there were multiple ones. There were so many concurrences, but I've read the briefing in the case for a couple of years, and I actually participated in the moot, so I know the issues really well, and I've never really been able to decide how I come out on the issue. I don't love more government regulation, put it bluntly.
Yeah.
More government being involved, I think can just end up being bad. But on the other hand, as you noted, I mean, these platforms really have tons and tons of ability to control the public discourse, and should they do that when they can censor everybody who calls into question whether the naturally immune needed the vaccine? That seems really problematic to me. And I don't, I don't know what the framers would have said. I always ask that question, but But yeah, I find it to be very complicated. And well, I mean, you're doing a lot of work to sort of preserve free speech in the future. So, and you said you're optimistic, even though I'm feeling pretty pessimistic after Murthy. So
yeah,
why don't we end on a note of optimism? If you want to tell listeners what you have going on for the future.
Yeah, I mean, I'm more pessimistic if I thought that the legal route was the only route to protect free speech. And I don't think that. I think it's important, and we should stay vigilant and we should keep fighting. But I do think there's other things that matter. And like you were saying, it's really for us, it's investigations into the government disinformation and censorship initiatives. And I emphasize government because, you know, there's a lot of people over the last few years that have kind of pushed back on cancel culture. And I am one of those people, been a victim of cancel culture for 20 years. I'm against cancel culture, you know, but it's not the same as censorship. I mean, censorship is the state, you know, and it's the involvement of the state in demanding censorship or directly or indirectly demanding censorship. And so for me, that's kind of the main event. And we've got this, you know, awful complex of government agencies, government funders, NGOs, universities, and others that are all working together to, you know, these are full of some of the worst people in society trying to decide what we can and can't say online and also spread misinformation. And
they're just
on behalf of
poor persecuted researchers.
Right. Yeah. These poor persecuted researchers demanding that their fellow citizens be shut up. You know, I think it's a totalitarian movement. I think it's full of people that are really quite lost and confused about what they're supposed to be doing, suffering from some kind of weird neuroses and maybe narcissism, entitlement. And yeah, those people, we have to keep a close eye on them. We're going to create we're getting much faster at identifying when they do stuff, you know, like in Europe, they were just doing all this stuff again about how the Russians were behind these, you know, conservative political parties and the Russians are doing this. And it's just a way to, you know, they wouldn't produce any evidence of it. They would just put these stories, the government just gets these stories in the newspapers and it has an impact on politics.
Yeah.
And then they also use it to censor. But so even when they don't use it to censor, it's a similar abuse of power in trying to manipulate public opinion using government resources and secretive illegal methods, in my view.
Right.
And
actually, before we end, I do want to ask you about that because
yeah.
I was on a panel the other day, and you know, I don't know if you recall the court. They said it at the oral argument in Murthy, and they also said it in their decision that the district court's opinion was replete with misrepresentations of the facts that had, you know, the plaintiffs had sort of started, and then the court just adopted. And I you know, I take issue with that. I don't think that's true. So I was participating in a debate about the decision, and my opponent, I asked him which facts, because he brought that up. And he said, well, all the stuff about the Stanford Internet Observatory, and these were just disinformation researchers who were doing their job, and their First Amendment rights are being violated by these investigations and lawsuits. And
God, so crazy.
I'd love to hear your retort to that.
So crazy. Well, yeah. So, I mean, it starts when we start attacking them, really. I mean, there was another guy, Mike Benz, who had done this incredible research into these Department of Homeland Security aligned and initiated organizations, basically asking DHS is really the government agency that I think is maybe the leadership. It's where they hide a censorship initiative inside of cybersecurity. And this starts with a preceding initiative called the Cyber Threat Intelligence League. And then it really gets going under Renee DiResta at Stanford Internet Observatory. I mean, she ostensibly has a boss, Alex Stamos, but she's the brains of the operation. And there's three other think tanks, University of Washington, Graphica, and Atlantic Council's DFR lab. You know, and these are people with, you know, I mean, you know, Renee worked at the CIA. You know, according to Alex Stamos, went to work with the CIA. She's a very suspicious career trajectory. There's other people with clear ties to the intelligence communities, you know, and they basically oversee a mass censorship advocacy effort where they're mass flagging accounts, trying to stop whole narratives, lobbying Twitter and the other social media platforms to do this. So yeah, to characterize them as just doing sort of research is like ridiculous. They're like really, really aggressive advocates for censorship.
And what's your response to people who say that they're not government actors? So it's
Yeah,
like,
and you kind of go, well, first of all, in the case of Stanford Internet Observatory, it received an NSF grant. So you receive a government grant, then I don't know what how much more government you need. You're being funded by the government. And they're also acting as a cutout. And I think it's important for people that don't know what that word means to people don't understand that there's ways that the intelligence community operates, and it's through what are called cutouts, which are known as intermediary organizations that the government largely controls and sort of drives their behavior and what they do, but at arm's length. And it's really not that hard to do. Like, you find other sources of money, you don't have any direct relationship, but you know it's happening because you can see that basically their behaviors are identical to what the governments are doing. And then they end up going to the same meetings and the same, holding little Zoom calls with each other as limited hangouts. So there's a kind of tradecraft part of this work that, if you don't know anything about how the intelligence community, like the CIA and the FBI and these guys have operated, it all may sound like a conspiracy theory. And if you do know how those organizations function, and this is my background, just to bring it all full circle, my own background from, being on the left, this is something that people, particularly if you grew up in the 70s and 80s, you learn about how the CIA and the intelligence communities operate, and they operate through these intermediaries and cutouts. And so coincidentally, we see all these people with relationships with the CIA and the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI, and it's clearly there's clearly governments are doing something here, and they're being weaponized. That's the name of the committee that Congressman Jim Jordan created, the weaponization of government. It's pretty well established at this point, a lot of evidence for it. So, to say after everything that's gone on that they're just doing research and that they're sort of somehow academics, it's just dishonest. And I don't even think that the people who say that believe it. I think they know exactly what's going on.
And saying that their first, this is the thing, I guess this is the line I've got, but their First Amendment rights are being violated. I'm sorry, if you're engaged in activity that's controversial, people might, have questions about it, and they might even write pieces about how you're doing stuff that's not very
No,
American.
they're saying that by us criticizing them
Right,
publicly,
right.
that we're depriving their First Amendment rights. It's so gross
Yeah.
because it's such a gross, it's just such a
Twisting.
gross
It's a twisting.
lie.
Yeah.
It's so weird and it's so bad. And I mean, that's very typical of these guys. They're all right now, they're all, because we're beating them to some extent, so it's fine, but they're all crying and complaining and they're playing the victim. And the ways they're playing the victim, it's really dishonest, and disingenuous, and they can't, it's just they can't, I know they can't possibly believe it. On the other hand, Renee lost her job, and I'm glad. I've said for years she needs to be kept very far away from the instruments of power, and I've got my eye on her, and I'll be talking about her. And if I, these guys, Jim Baker, the former general counsel for FBI, who just happens to end up as the deputy general counsel, taking a demotion to go work at Twitter at just the right moment in 2020 to declare the Hunter Biden laptop part of some vast Russian conspiracy. He just popped up again at some new election misinformation organization. I mean, these guys are relentless. They are
I know. And there's this, I
so.
mean, there's this revolving door of the, there was a, do you remember this text exchange with Jen Easterly from CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency, and Matt Masterson? And he had gone to LinkedIn, and it's, they're talking about how, the platforms really need to be, get more comfortable working with government to censor so-called disinformation. And I actually couldn't figure out if Matt Masterson was at LinkedIn or at CISA at the time this text was sent, because he was sort of going back and forth between the two. And so I'm like, are you a government actor? Aren't you? So it's, I mean, maybe one thing is like there needs to be legislation that you cannot go work for one of these companies like within a certain amount of time of, having worked for the government or something like that. I mean, on the other hand, that has its own implications. I'm very wary of more regulation. So all the online solutions, I'm just not sure how to deal with these things. But I really don't like that, because what they're doing is they're essentially using their authority and connections and everything they know from their government job and then going to the tech company, and they're effectively kind of double agents, in my opinion.
I mean, look, it should just be def I mean, the first step is defunding it all. I mean, the taxpayers are paying for the censorship.
Of
So it's
our
like,
dollars.
Yeah, I mean, the Soros and the Omidyars and the Craig Newmarks and the Aspen, you know, Aspen Institute is government funded. So, I mean, but I mean, those, the private philanthropists, they can fund people to demand censorship. I mean, that's, they can legally do that. I think it's awful. We should criticize them and denounce it, but they're allowed to do that. But like, yeah, like we can, we should phase out Track F funding at the National Science Foundation. We should, I think we should abolish the CISA within DHS. I will just say, absolutely, I've talked about that idea with members of Congress, and there's a lot of love still for CISA, and obviously cybersecurity is a real problem. So just fine, if they're not going to get rid of CISA, because I think the death penalty is an appropriate remedy for government agencies that violate the First Amendment, but if they're not going to do that, then just, you have to, they have, they must stop with this, with the whole misinfo disinfo thing. They have to stop. It has to be defunded.
Yeah.
You know, and yeah, I mean, like, look, you have government communicates, government should have communications and PR people and spokespeople, and they should do it publicly. But I would say anytime any of them, you know, if any of them are going to talk to social media platforms, they have to publicly announce it. I've advocated that for a year and a half, you know, like they, if you're going to call a social media platform, you have to just tweet about it. Be like, yeah, I just reached, we reached out to the social media platforms and asked them to take this down. Like, it just,
there's a proposed piece of legislation. I think it's from Massey, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It's yeah, the Transparency Act, where then I'm very, yes, I think that's great. Like, yeah, they have to basically publicize all their interactions with social,
yeah,
media. Now, I don't know if they'll actually comply, because who's going to stop them really from making phone calls, or they might.
Well,
just,
but if you have penalties on it, you have, right, penalties and investigations and subpoena power. Yeah, I'll get the FBI to investigate government agents that are secretly communicating with, you know, government officials secretly communicating. Yeah, send the FBI out after them.
Well,
you know,
and
I mean,
this is
go,
another issue that we have to do away with qualified immunity, because that's just so, I mean, that's so terrible for this. But that means that, so for people who don't know, that's the government, you know, when you sue a government official, you sue them in their official capacity for the most part. So
yeah,
it's their office. So they actually, no person is actually held accountable. They leave the office, they're no longer in the lawsuit. Even if,
right,
they are still in the office, they don't pay out of their own pocket. They don't suffer any personal,
right,
consequences.
Right.
And we can't, you know, this cannot go on. If you're demanding the censorship of Americans or certain ideas in America, you're obviously violating the First Amendment, and
right,
you shouldn't get any kind of immunity.
Yeah, and I guess, again, that gets back to the line between, if you're a government official, can you talk, can you ask, you know, social media platforms, you know, because it is tricky, because you kind of go, they will keep calling and talking, and right now it's not illegal, and, you know, the risk is that these committees reestablish themselves and get government funding to go do this in a mass way. You know, the transparency feels like a really good, like, it calls the bluff of the Kavanaughs of the world, who are like, I was at the White House and I would call up the journalists. It's like, okay, great, you're gonna do, that's fine, but now you just gotta, if you're gonna do, because it's secretive and it's a big tech platform, you have to immediately announce it in a press release and in all the social media platforms, and it would immediately dull the impact of the lobbying, because there would be public scrutiny of the platforms if they start censoring in the ways demanded by government officials.
Right, right. Well, I could keep talking to you all day, but I think we both have other things to do. So thank you so, so much for doing this. I think it was a very important and interesting discussion.
Always a pleasure. Thanks, Janine. Thanks,
yeah,
to you and your good work.
Can you tell listeners where they can find you?
Sure. It's I'm on X, as I've been saying. So Schellenberger, at Schellenberger on X, or Public is the name of the Substack.
Great. Thank you so much. And I will talk to you soon.